KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
Coming up, why are longtime working Oakland residents part of the city's homeless population?
I've had a catering business in Oakland for 30 years. We can't afford nothing here. You got to make three times the amount of rent to qualify.
Then why the high price of California gas isn't just about taxes.
Well, they're ignoring this twice as large mystery surcharge that is not going to building roads.
And the bard comes to Bay Area Beats. We'll hear how Shakespeare provides the lyrics for a San Francisco band.
I think the reason using Shakespeare was compelling to me is I felt like there's a lifetime of material.
What light through yonder window breaks is Cross Currents. Coming up next. Housing costs have risen dramatically in Oakland the past few years, and so has the number of people without homes. An Alameda County report estimates that as many as 9,000 people in Oakland are unhoused. That's the largest in the county. A majority of them are people of color, and many are employed. The United Nations describes what's happening in Oakland as cruel and a violation of multiple human rights. KLW reporter Janae Darden went to a forum on the homeless issue in Oakland. She's here with me today to talk about that and a homeless encampment she visited that the city is threatening to evict. Hey, Janae.
Hey.
So the homeless population counts seem to have changed dramatically. Some reports say nearly 2,800. You're quoting 9,000. Where did you get those figures?
So, Hannah, I went to a presentation by a homeless advocate, and they issued a report called Housing Oakland Unhoused. And it was a collaboration between the East Oakland Collective, Dellums Institute for Social Justice, and The Village. And the event drew a number of politicians and people who are unhoused.
Okay, so but why the huge gap in numbers?
Right. So the smaller numbers, they reflect people like sleeping on the streets and shelters. The higher numbers take into account people couch surfing, hospitalized, you know, jailed overnight. Those are people they may not be able to count on the street.
Yeah. Okay, so some people think of those who are homeless as having mental health issues, being veterans, addicted to drugs. Some people, you know, and some assume people who are homeless just don't want a job, but many are currently working.
Right. And, you know, people with mental health issues and veterans, they do unfortunately have higher rates of homelessness. But many of the people on the streets in Oakland are working. And I met a young man who works at Pixar as a dishwasher, and he sleeps in his car, and he can't afford to even rent here. But race plays a role here, too. So guess how many of those unhoused in Oakland are black? Guess.
52%?
68%.
Oh, wow. That's big. That's a lot.
That is a lot. Now, high cost of living is a factor. Now, you remember the housing market crash around 10 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. Caused by the housing bubble. So some of those black people who are now unhoused, their homes were foreclosed because of mortgage scams. And those scams hit people of color hard, especially African Americans. Many are from West Oakland and East Oakland, which have large black populations. Mm-hmm. About 11,000 black people and other people of color lost their homes around that time of the market crash.
So what else is fueling this homeless crisis in Oakland?
Incarceration. Mm-hmm. People who get out of jail, they can't find jobs, can't afford to pay rent. Mm-hmm. One man who was homeless and spoke at the event, he served time and said there are Section 8 policies that can hinder someone with a criminal record from getting housing.
Mm. And did they suggest a solution?
They presented a plan for the city and the county to house 2,000 people in 6 months to a year.
How are they going to do that?
Right. People are like, am I paying for that? Mm-hmm. So they're saying, they're suggesting building tiny homes, allowing mobile homes on public land. Oakland has 50 parcels of public land, and the report says that's enough for 7,300 affordable housing units.
And now back to your question, who's going to pay for it?
The report suggests using state and county funds that are supposed to go toward the homeless crisis. So the plan is short term for about 3 to 10 years and would cost $23 million, but they think a longer term goal would cost over $200 million. And I don't know if this is the best plan, but they think this problem can be taken care of.
Okay, so Janae, you went to a homeless encampment over the weekend, and it's fighting the city. What's happening?
So at the end of October, the orgs that I mentioned earlier, East Oakland Collective, The Village, they set up a community for unhoused people on a lot in Brookfield neighborhood in East Oakland. Mm-hmm. And that lot has been vacant for a number of years. It's on public land. And so they call this the Housing and Dignity Village. And a day after the election, the city sent them an eviction notice, which says the encampment is illegal and uninhabitable.
Then what happened?
So the cops threatened to show up on Saturday morning to evict them. And the organizations, they put a call out to the community and local housing advocates to show up if the police come. And so the orgs also filed a restraining order against the city, and they filed a lawsuit. The police didn't come. They invited a lot of media, too. But the volunteers stayed, and they did some work on the property.
So what did it look like over there?
Hana, it was really, I've been to other encampments, and it was really clean and organized. Mm-hmm. They have several tents for the people who live there. They had a pizza oven to cook food. Mm-hmm. They had a pantry, a medical and wellness tent, Wi-Fi.
Wi-Fi.
They had Wi-Fi and invited people in the neighborhood to use the Wi-Fi, composting toilets. It is a women-run encampment.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I spoke to Nita B. She is a co-founder of The Village, and she stays on the property. And she's owned a catering business in Oakland for 30 years. She's unhoused because she and her family, they can't afford rent here.
This is an encampment that centers the needs of women, which you don't see in any of the encampments. There is not a homeless woman I've met who has not yet been raped. And we decide which men get to come on. So we are trying to create a place where we as women can have a place where we know we won't fall through the cracks.
So, wow, sounds like an important space. How long will they be able to stay on this lot?
Well, that's to be determined. They're going to court today. So we'll know more soon, but there may be other court battles like this in the near future because another encampment in East Oakland was served an eviction notice last week. Mm. So I'll keep you posted.
All right. Thank you, Janae. I know you will. Thanks.
Thank you.
Janae Darden covers East Oakland for KLW. We've got a link to Housing Oakland's Unhoused report at KLW.org. And actually, they just shared an update on their Facebook page that they got a 2-week extension on their restraining order. Check out our website for more information on that, too. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This weekend, gas prices topped $4 a gallon at some stations in the Bay Area. Now, fuel in California usually costs more than any other state in the continental U.S. That's one of the reasons we just had a huge ballot fight over repealing the 12-cent gas tax that was passed last year. But Berkeley economist Severin Bornstein says high taxes and regulations alone can't explain why our gas costs so much. KLW's transportation reporter Eli Wertschafter asked him to explain what he calls California's mystery gas surcharge.
Let's start in 2015. What happens in 2015 and what does that do to gas prices in California?
Well, in February of 2015, the Torrance Refinery in Southern California, which is one of the bigger producers of California gasoline, had a major fire and had to shut down. As a result, we saw a big spike in California gasoline prices, which we always see when a refinery has a problem in California.
And why do prices usually spike?
Because the supply is reduced and Californians still want to drive just as much. And so we need to start importing a lot more gasoline from other parts of the world. And those refineries have to switch over to making California special blend, and that costs more. So when we get these refinery disruptions, we get a price spike. Usually the price spike lasts a month or 2 months. In this case, it went up and it's never really come down to the normal relationship with the rest of the country. Our prices have remained about 23 or 24 cents higher than you would normally expect them to be averaged over the whole year. And that costs real money because at the current extra surcharge rate, we're paying somewhere between $3 and $4 billion a year extra for gasoline above what we'd normally expect to pay.
And for an individual person, say you drive in California every day, Do you know how much that would cost you throughout a year?
Well, if you have a family of four and you count not just the gasoline you're directly buying, but also the effect it has on groceries and all the things that companies have to pay for, that means that you're paying probably about an extra dollar a day or over $300 a year in extra payments for gasoline above and beyond the fact that we have somewhat higher taxes and we pay for a cleaner burning gasoline.
Hmm. So what could be behind this markup in gas prices in California?
Let me point out a couple of things that are at least concerning, but I want to be clear. We don't know what the cause is. One thing is that in most of the rest of the United States, about 90% of stations set their own prices without much influence from the refiners. In California, about half of all stations are under a different sort of wholesale distribution that gives the refiner a lot more power to influence the price of the retailer by essentially setting different prices for very small areas, sometimes for individual stations. If you're in a rich neighborhood, maybe you pay more, or if you have less competition, you as a gas station pay more because that's how the upstream company is extracting some of those profits.
Got it. So instead of being like, we're a giant supermarket of milk, everyone can come here and pay $2.79 for milk,
whatever,
they're going around with their little milk carts saying, hey, for you in this neighborhood, it's $3. For you in this neighborhood, it's $3.50.
Right. Is that the cause? I'm not sure. But there's definitely a big difference between California and the rest of the country in that area.
It's almost like after the refinery explosion in 2015, the industry realized they could get away with selling gas at a more expensive rate and then kind of just never went back down because, like, well, all right, people are still paying for it.
Yeah, it's possible that part of what happened is that the gasoline sellers had this power years before, but hadn't realized it or hadn't realized how much power they had until the 2015 explosion and the price going way up and realizing, actually, we could make more money by selling a little less gasoline, but selling it at higher prices.
What could the state do to try to rein it in?
So if the state found out that the problem is in the distribution system, they might be able to affect the concentration of ownership of the distribution system.
What would that mean?
Certainly they would fight hard, they would fight more and perhaps more successfully against future mergers among the companies that distribute gasoline.
Okay, because if there's fewer companies, it's sort of easier for them to keep prices high and not compete with each other.
One thing they might do is try to see if there are ways to encourage refineries in other parts of this country and world to produce California blend gasoline. There are lots of complaints from the industry, and I'm sure some of them are based in real concerns, that regulatory barriers reduce the amount of supply we can bring in. I would want to look into that.
Is it such a bad thing to have expensive gas if that's encouraging us to drive less and pollute less?
I think it would be a fine thing to have more expensive gas if the money were going to a use that people were comfortable with. And so if it were actually getting, say, reducing state taxes or taxes on workers, I think that'd be great. But that's not where the money's going. Those other taxes that we pay are going to build roads and to help the state budget and so forth. This money is going somewhere else. It's going to companies. And maybe it's necessary to cover some costs that we're not aware of, but I think it's quite possible it's just going to the bottom line, and that I'm not as comfortable with.
What's it been like for you to watch this debate over repealing a 12-cent gas tax, knowing that there is this other, 20-cent or more extra charge, its markup, that Californians are paying for gas that we're not talking about at all?
It's been very frustrating to watch the debate over Prop 6. I think that it feels like the little kid yelling, look over here, look what's going on in this corner, when something much less important is going on elsewhere that everybody's distracted by. This twice as large mystery surcharge that is not going to building roads and is not going to helping people cope with the high cost of gasoline. the state should be putting in more resources to figure this out. If they did a $10 million study, it still would be a drop in the bucket compared to the overcharging we're seeing. I have gotten inquiries from a number of legislators saying, I'd like to talk to you more about this. Most of them said after the election because, you know, there were a lot of other things on the agenda, including Proposition 6. But now that we are past the election, I hope that we are going to see some action to address this.
That was KALW's Eli Wirtschafter speaking with UC Berkeley economist Severin Bornstein, a director of the Energy Institute at Haas School of Business. You can find a link to the professor's article called California's Real Gasoline Tax Problems at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Songwriting can be a challenge. So when San Francisco musician Carl Diggernis found himself battling writer's block, he started reading the texts from plays written by William Shakespeare for some lyrical inspiration, and it worked. Carl reached out to collaborator and friend Mina Choi of Magic Magic Orchestra, and along with his Shakespearean cover band, The Frail Ophelias, they created a project that combined modern rock and folk music with scenes from the Shakespeare tragedy Macbeth. For this edition of Bay Area Beats, Carl and Mina stopped by KALW to discuss just how Macbeth's themes from 400 years ago are still relevant today.
My name is Carl Diggernis.
And my name is Mina Choi.
I'm a musician, a songwriter, a music director here in San Francisco.
I am also a musician. I do mostly composing and arranging for strings and things through my group, Magic Magic Orchestra. For mother of a soul, you have left an open grave for me. Carl and I have worked together for a long time. And we both work at a church called City Church San Francisco. Carl hired me on about 9 years ago in 2010. Carl's the lead music director, lead worship director at this church. As soon as I started working with Carl, we're really musical kindred spirits. And, you know, he has written so many songs, mostly up until Frail Ophelias, within the church context, you know, songs that are to be sung on Sunday at churches all around the U.S. The Frail Ophelias is Carl's band that you started, I don't know, like 4 years ago?
Yeah, 4 or 5 years ago.
And it's a band that's really cool. It's every album is based off of a different Shakespearean play. And this is the first one, which is based off of Macbeth. All the songs are based off of what happens in the story. Some text is pulled directly from the play itself. And for some songs, he commissioned some local poets to take a certain scene and write their own words and describe that scene in their own words. And then he set all of that very beautifully to music. It's like a song cycle, it's an album. I don't know if it's a concept album, maybe it is a concept album, but it is all based off of Macbeth. And Carl sings lead on all the songs, and a lot of it is acoustic guitar based, but there's some like piano based things as well. And
there's some banjo.
Some banjo, yeah. Hide your lies, postpone the morning, hand over time tonight, out, out, spot quit me now.
think the reason using Shakespeare was compelling to me is I got to a place creatively where I realized that I needed starter material to work with. And I'd always been interested in Shakespeare, didn't really know a whole lot about it, but I felt like there's a lifetime of material to work through and work with. And it also helps that it's public domain, so it makes it nice and malleable, easy to work with. Hopefully just to respect the text, but also to be able to do something new with it.
As another singer-songwriter, I'm a little jealous of that idea. It's a little bit of a cheat to start with one of the best wordsmiths in the history of humankind. You're already starting from such a high level. And
yeah, there's only you can only go down. So.
Our tears will drown the wind, falling from a broken sky that angels cannot mend. Oh, your soul will take its flight.
Lyric writing has always been intimidating to me, and something that has been hard and difficult to approach. But I feel like having that starter, a place to start, really helps the writing process.
I also agree that writing lyrics, to me, is that the hardest part for you?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's the thing I probably put under the microscope too much.
Courier of dreadful.
It's the last part of the process for me, the one that I just have to do, like, kicking and screaming. I hate writing lyrics. And so to have all your lyrics kind of written for you, even before you start, is it really frees up, I think, creatively. You're not, like, nervous. You can just do the part that you really, really love.
Double, double, toil and trouble. Fire burning, cauldron bubble. By the pricking of my thumb.
I would hope that people would find the music accessible in that, in the fact that I hope it's possible that you'd hear the song and not know immediately that it's Shakespeare. I wanted to honor the text for sure. It feels almost sacred, but also be loose with it and to be able to play with it a little bit. And I was able to commission a local poet, Annalise Sagervelt, to take a couple of passages and what's known as erasure poetry, where you take a text and then you start kind of erasing and basically choosing words here and there and phrases and then remixing them back together again into something that's altogether new.
Something wicked this way comes. Billy of a finny sleep in the cauldron boiling big scale of dragon tooth of wolf.
Yeah, it's been a very very fruitful relationship.
It would be hard for me to imagine doing a project without Mina's help.
To be able to sing harmony with Carl and sing a duet on his album called Stars Hide Your Fires, which is a duet between Macbeth and Lady Macbeth,
yeah.
That was really, really fun. But yeah, working with Carl is so easy, because the hardest part of working with someone when you're a musician is figuring out the communication and building trust in that collaboration, knowing that when you suggest something, the other person is going to be offended or hurt, or you can just really be honest, but trust each other's ideas. So we have that because we've been working for almost 10 years.
Against these dark imaginings, you are but a simple man. You are but a feeble heart. I have the darkest plan.
I love singing with Carl. I love singing harmony with other people. If I could only choose one thing to do in music for the rest of my life, it would be sing harmony with another human being on anything. That's just my great joy.
You can catch Mina Choi along with Carl Diggernis and the Frail Ophelias at their Macbeth album release show. It's happening this Thursday night at the Swedish American Hall in San Francisco. Find all the details at KALW.org. That piece was produced by Tarek Foda. And while you're at KALW, go ahead and click on the Cross Currents tab and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Stay up on what's happening all over the Bay Area, and it comes free right in your inbox. Today's Cross Currents team includes Joanne DeLuna, Angela Johnston, Sarah Coast, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Aaliyah Yates. Gabe Graben, Tarek Foda, and James Rollins engineer the show. Shireen Adil is our content manager. David Boyer is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Healing Potpourri from San Francisco. They are playing at the soon-to-be-closed Elbow Room in the city tomorrow night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.